It's just about 7:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name's Brian Edwards Tiegert. The Robert McFarlane interview we promised you has succumbed to some technical problems, probably not a result of cyber warfare, and we'll get it fixed up and on another morning. Instead, we're going to bring you an incredible interview that our intern Justin Gold did on the subject of Hollywood Jim Crow. Here it is. Okay, looks like that might be succumbing to some technical problems as well.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Justin Gold. Films like Moonlight, Black Panther, Get Out, Us, If Beale Street Could Talk, and others have outperformed their budgets and shattered expectations at the box office. Despite this commercial success, black directors still find themselves with smaller budgets and fewer opportunities. From smaller budgets to inequities in the way their films are distributed, black directors are faced with race-based discrimination at almost every turn. That's the topic of our next guest book, which examines how racial hierarchies in Hollywood actually mirror practices of the Jim Crow South to marginalize black directors. We're joined in studio today by Dr. Marianne Arriga. Marianne is assistant professor in the Department of Sociology, as well as the Institute of African American Studies at the University of Georgia, and is just out with her new book, The Hollywood Jim Crow. Marianne, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Justin.
So I want to go ahead and start by getting sort of a lay of the land of the book. Can you go ahead and set the table by briefly detailing what the struggle for black directors, specifically in inclusion in Hollywood, has looked like for most of the 20th century?
Yeah, in the beginning, there was absolutely no inclusion for black directors. You're thinking from beginning of Hollywood period up until about the 1960s, the late 1960s, there were no black directors in Hollywood, and blacks were only included in some ways as actors. You can think of people like Sidney Poitier, for example, who was a prominent actor. But directors then made their way into Hollywood in the late 1960s and also the early 1970s, especially with like the blaxploitation films of the 1970s. They were very popular. But still, we had very few black directors making movies that were defining black communities. That more so came in the 1980s with people like Spike Lee and John Singleton, and black female directors gained access to Hollywood in the 1990s, people like Cheryl Denier and others. And even, I guess, in the 2000s as well, there were a lot more access to big budget directing movies. People like Antoine Fuqua gained access to that period. And now we're looking in a period where there's limited access in some ways, although a lot of black directors are directing movies, we see that how they're included is very limited.
If you could spell it out for us, what are some of the challenges black directors are facing under the Hollywood Jim Crow, as you've dubbed it?
Right. So I got as you can tell, probably I got the inspiration of the title from Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. And she talks about how the racial hierarchy exists within mass incarceration is linked to that hierarchy that we see previously in the Jim Crow era. And by that, I mean the idea that representation is very limited in Hollywood. With Jim Crow, there's a lot of ways that people are not having access. You can think of things like voting rights or even things, just some examples. You can think of things like voting rights, and also you can think of how housing, schools, employment, all other aspects of society are closed off to people, where you have the best access given to whites and the most prestigious opportunities given to whites, and other racial minority groups, including blacks, are disadvantaged in that way. And so we see a lot of that in Hollywood in terms of the racial hierarchy. For example, when you look at who's directing these big budget, lucrative franchise movies, those tend to go to white directors. And those are the movies that have $300 million, $200 million budgets, even $150 million and plus, so on, tend to go to white directors. And very few of those movies go to black directors or even some directors who are Asian or Latino. But specifically, we look at that kind of hierarchy of the prestigious films in genres like action and sci-fi for the biggest budgets, which, by the way, are the movies that get the most distribution globally. We tend to see fewer of those going to black directors. In addition, we see a limited genre. So I talked a little bit about sci-fi and action being genres where you don't see a lot of black directors. And some of this is playing on to stereotypes of blacks and having this musical performance as opposed to being seen in these intellectual arenas.
Right. So one of the things you talked about was representation in your answer. And I was interested to see that in the book, you make the point that equality won't necessarily be achieved in a numerical or a demographic sense. So what does equitable representation look like?
So equity is very important in Hollywood, and numbers is one aspect of that equity. For example, we'd like to see 13% of the Black population directing Hollywood movies, just like we'd like to see 16% of Latinos directing Hollywood movies also. But we can't necessarily just focus on that specific point, because we can say, well, let's look and see if these numbers are progressing. But there's another way to look at the inequality, and that's to look at what movies people are directing. So I think one way to gain equity is for Black directors to have more access to these big budget movies, and also to have more control in the production in Hollywood, to be able to dictate the kinds of movies that they direct, and also to be able to not just direct the next Marvel movie or direct the next big Hollywood movie, but also have their own projects get that kind of lucrative funding.
You talk about this idea of cultural citizenship. So would you be able to sort of define cultural citizenship and why cultural citizenship is important, particularly when it comes to Black directors and representation for Black people in America?
Right. Cultural citizenship, I think there's one aspect of citizenship that we always understand, and there's the access of voting rights is one aspect of citizenship that's very popular. There's also the aspect of citizenship in terms of being an immigrant versus being a citizen, having that status. But we don't think about the other ways that people are belonging in the United States. Oftentimes, we think of citizenship in very limited terms, in terms of politics, but not so much in terms of culture. So with cultural citizenship, I'm thinking of how groups are integrated into the cultural myths and narratives of the whole nation. The question of what myths and narratives, what movies represent the United States? If we were to go to an international film festival, do we see a lot of representation from the multicultural groups in the U.S., or do we see a very limited representation? So when I'm asking the question about cultural citizenship, I'm really thinking about how Blacks and other groups can be embedded in this idea of the nation and idea of citizenship and culture, as opposed to just being second-class citizens and that they don't have their images and their narratives portrayed in mainstream movies.
When Black directors do get opportunities, right, they're sort of hired to direct very specific niche films. So while it is great to have, you know, Black directors and Black people telling Black stories, does being hired specifically for the purpose of directing the quote-unquote Black movie, does that pigeonhole Black directors in any way or stifle their career growth?
Yeah, it tends to sometimes stifle their career growth, and not necessarily just because it's a movie with Black cast, but it's really about the stigma that Hollywood tends to have about movies with Black cast. So generally, one of the points I make in the book is that there's this stigma, and it comes from the words of Hollywood people themselves, like Hollywood insiders, I call them, like producers, directors, studio executives, others who work in Hollywood. And I got a lot of this information from what was leaked on WikiLeaks from the Sony hack. And some of this, we hear these people, Hollywood insiders, talk about how they don't believe that movies with Black cast and Black directors will make as much money and won't be as profitable overseas as movies with white cast and white directors. So the only reason why I think dubbing their movies Black movies pigeonholes them is that those movies tend to get smaller budgets from Hollywood studios than movies that are not branded in that same way. Although I think that as Black Panther and other movies, I think Us recently as well showed that movies with Black stars and Black casts can do well overseas and also can attract audiences from Black audiences, but also from other audiences of other races. But still, there tends to be this stigma attached to Blackness in Hollywood, and that really pigeonholes people and prevents them from accessing the same kind of career opportunities that it does for white directors.
And so when you talk about this stigma, like you write about the stigma of Black, or, you know, making Black unbankable, where does that stigma come from and why does it persist?
Yeah, there's a whole history, I guess, in terms of why there's a stigma attached to Blackness. Earlier, much earlier on, W.E.B. Du Bois, who is a pioneering sociologist, talked about this idea of a Negro problem, and how whites in general were branding Negroes or branding Blacks in that time period as a problem race that needed to be resolved. And so in this same way, we see this language being used and also being co-opted in the way that Hollywood producers and directors and studio executives talk about Black movies. And part of it is they're perceiving Black casts as narrow in particular, as opposed to being universal and opposed to being movies that all audiences would appreciate. And also, they tend to brand white movies as human universal human and universal in contrast to that stigma. So in general, when Black directors do direct movies, they have a pressure to direct movies with multiracial or white casts as they progress in their careers in order to attain bigger production budgets. And that's due to that stigma that they face. So we see that there's a longstanding history of attaching Blackness to devaluation, to negative aspects, and also to stigma. And it's really part and parcel of U.S. history that there's always been this lingering sense of anti-Blackness that has always impacted Blacks in their career pursuits.
One of the interesting things, I think, in the wake of, you know, Oscar So White and all these award shows that we expend, you know, all of our energy either defending or talking about, things like that, it seems to be that the common retort is that, you know, Black people shouldn't concern themselves with the award shows because they are just, you know, hollow things that are given out, and they don't really tell the real picture of whether something's quality or whether something's not quality. And a section of your book, you carve out a section of it to talk about the ways in which these types of awards and symbolic gestures actually are important. So why are awards like the Oscars and other forms of symbolic gestures so important in Hollywood?
Yeah, symbols are very important. I think they send a message that something is possible. And even with Hollywood, we talk about the idea of African-American president or half white, half black president, as Barack Obama is. But even that picture was presented to us in Hollywood before it ever became a reality in real social life. So this idea that symbols have power, they give people conceptions of things that maybe don't exist, but they give people ideas of what could be in the future. So there's this one way that they have this imaginary power. In addition, they're embedded into the narratives and lives of people all over the world. So globally, people watch these award shows, they take in these symbols, and they remember these symbols. People remember who won an Oscar in the 1930s and 40s. And so those awards, while they may seem trivial in the contemporary moment, we still talk about Hattie McDaniel's Oscar for Gone with the Wind. As much as people critique that movie and they critique her role, that role is partly alive because of its award at the Oscars for her as Best Supporting Actress way back when. So symbols have a lasting power in a sense that they bring some of these historic events to our current memory.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Justin Gold. I am in conversation with Dr. Marianne Arriaga, discussing her latest book, The Hollywood Jim Crow. How do awards, particularly concerning Black directors, Black actors, how does the assigning of awards to those films, I mean, if you think of Moonlight, right? Like, how does the assignment of awards to those films propel Black directors further along the path of equity and inclusion in Hollywood?
Definitely gives them more recognition. Barry Jenkins, I believe his career trajectory has really exploded since winning that award, and he's given a lot more latitude and opportunity to then progress on other projects. Others that win awards, also, we see them recurring in different roles, and you can say some more than others. I think for directors, it definitely matters. We haven't seen a lot of Black directors awarded. Steve McQueen won for the Best Picture Award for 12 Years a Slave, and Barry Jenkins as well. But we haven't seen any Black directors win for Best Director, which is really surprising because I've seen a lot of great movies lately. And so some of them that were either nominated or didn't win, I think those directors' careers could really get a boost from that award. And we see a little bit less boost from actors, like Gabori Sidibe is one who you haven't really seen her in a feature role where she probably could carry a feature role. So we can say that boost is not necessarily the same for actors as it is for directors, but I think it definitely helps to give them some kind of career status and latitude in their future projects.
Right. And it's so interesting that you talk about, you know, latitude and giving them, you know, credibility and the ability to sort of move into different arenas within the film industry. And there was a particular part in the book where you talk about the concept of tentpole franchises and how Black directors are rarely, if ever, given the opportunity to direct those. And those are some of the franchises that end up, you know, doing really well and end up lending credibility to directors. So would you be able to talk about what tentpole franchises are and their importance in terms of being able to give Black directors more visibility and more latitude?
Yeah, tentpole franchises are as the word describes, this idea of, I don't know if anyone sleeps in tents anymore. Do you think maybe on an odd vacation or something like that, they may go camping? But if you can imagine the shape of a tent and how it's held in the center by a pole, that's really what's holding these studios together. They make so much money and they have so much publicity and visibility from these movies, not just from their debuts and their theatrical releases, but also from other aspects. So they sell things like dolls and theme parks and t-shirts and all sorts of things, even video games from these tentpole franchises. And those movies give directors a lot of prestige and a lot of power, and they're very lucrative. And those are positions where typically white directors and typically white male directors are the ones who are directing those movies. And we see fewer and fewer of those opportunities go to black directors. So that's one of the key ways in which we have that inequality fixated in Hollywood, where black directors are just kept out of the lucrative opportunities. They just are not given those kinds of movies to direct. And Black Panther is just pretty much the only exception. There's another movie, I think, with the Fast and the Furious franchise, where a black director directed that for a pretty hefty budget, but that was a more recent movie as well. But we see that historically they've been kept out of that very lucrative genre. And even now, just maybe one or two directors might get in, but in general, there's this rule where they're kept out of those lucrative positions, although they do have the opportunity, or they do have the ability to direct those movies, but they're just really kept out. And that's one of the ways we see this Jim Crow stratification, where the hierarchy is that whites get those opportunities and blacks don't.
One of the things that I was really surprised to see in the book were really, you know, how much smaller the budgets that black directors get to black casts get to work with versus those compared to white directors with white or black or multiracial casts. Why is understanding the difference in the allocation of budgets important to understanding the plight, again, that black directors are dealing with here in Hollywood?
Yeah, the allocation of budgets is very important to understanding their plight. I think like you're suggesting, there is this question of, will blacks be able to participate in institutions broadly? You know, is there inclusion? And I think one big part of that inclusion is about economic inclusion and financial inclusion. When it comes to Hollywood, a big part of that is having the sufficient budget in order to make a great movie. Of course, there are great movies made on smaller budgets, but when we talk about the movies with the big visual effects and special effects, then of course you need more money to make those movies. And then you have these different tiers of directors based on their access to those funds. So I think a lot of the inclusion we talk about in society broadly, we cannot leave out this question of economic inclusion. Even we can make the parallel jump to things like neighborhoods. Where are the black neighborhoods with swimming pools and million-dollar mansions? You know, are there any neighborhoods like that in the United States? Do any such neighborhoods exist? I think that's a parallel question we have for Hollywood, where we don't really see a lot of movies with black casts or even just a few black actors having those big budgets. So we do see that inequality that exists across many different spheres of social life. If we really look at those kinds of inequalities, even something like private schools, or, you know, where are the black private schools that have a lot of money? There's not a lot of entities, although there are many, many millions, tens of millions of black people in the United States. We still see that there's that economic inclusion left out. And that's part of why this Jim Crow Hollywood resonates with a lot of people today.
You talk about the idea that black directors and black films are sort of chained together. Why is it that success doesn't uplift and lead to more opportunity for black directors, but failure ultimately restricts opportunity across the board for black directors?
There's a way that people characterize this notion of the failure of blackness is attached to all in a way that when blacks are successful, then they're viewed as an exception to the rule, but when they're failing, then it views as the general rule. And it's hard to break that mindset, because that's another key aspect of racism in the United States, where we don't see, there's a constant branding of black success as the exception, or as the one that's different from the rest of the others. You know, we can think about tokenism and other terminologies to discuss this. And I think it's very relevant in Hollywood, where we don't look at black success as being a norm, but rather, Hollywood producers and studio executives look at it as being an exception. Even no matter how many successes there are, a lot of directors, black directors, do joke about the fact that every time a movie comes out, then Hollywood insiders are really celebrating, like, oh, that was, there's a way that they frame the success of the movie to say that it was an exception and that that they were surprised that it was successful. Although that framing happens often, even though there have been prior successes, you can look and see that framing happens like every so many years, although there are a long history of successful Black movies dating decades ago. But still, they're framing that as a success to mark Black success as an exception and really as a way to exclude Blacks from participation.
In the book, you sort of talk about how the white executives place the burden or reason why the Black directors' movies either aren't being distributed or aren't being produced or made or not given opportunities to because of the way that the audience is going to receive it or that the audience doesn't want to see Black films or things like that. Can you talk about the faulty logic there and the shifting of blame from the individual's own ideas onto the general populace?
Yeah, the idea that the audience is racist, and especially this idea that the foreign audiences are racist. What came out of a lot of the emails on WikiLeaks was that executives thought that, or at least they would suggest that, it's not that they didn't want to distribute movies with Black casts or directors to white audiences, but rather the foreign audiences were the ones that were giving them the signal that they don't like these kinds of movies, that they won't consume them or patronize them. And there's this sense of shifting the blame on to really just shift the idea of racism to the consumer. And I think that's a very interesting way of shifting the idea of racism in this era of capitalism in the 21st century. And let's not talk about producers being racist, or let's not talk about producers making decisions in the front end to exclude groups, but rather let's talk about the consumption. So again, there's a definitely a lot of circular logic and circular reasoning going on with those explanations, but it's always a shifting target with the idea of racism under the new Jim Crow or the Hollywood Jim Crow or the Jim Crow of the past. You know, we always see these different reasons, whether it's a biological reason or a cultural reason or some other reason for racism persisting. It definitely shifts focus, but it still maintains its strength and its power.
What kind of organizing or things are going on within the industry right now to try to get us to a place of equitable representation?
I can speak about one program I know in particular, the Inclusion Writer, where some actors are insisting that films should require diversity, and they're putting that on their own backs. I guess they're standing up for, you can say, racial or gender diversity in the way with this Inclusion Writers program, and they're negotiating that as part of their contract to perform in a movie. And I think that's one laudable thing that's happening in Hollywood right now. What I would love to see happen is more organization on behalf of these different groups, especially for Black directors who have this long tradition and long history of making phenomenal movies. I would love to see a lot of that back-end organization where Black groups think about what movies they want to see in theaters every single year. And let's have this idea of what kind of movies would we see? What slate of movies would we see? What kind of stories do Black communities want to tell? And to really organize that production in the same way that there's a very organized production of Hollywood movies. I don't know if anyone has studied what kinds of movies come out of Hollywood, but if you notice, there's a lot of patterns in the kinds of movies that come out, and the plots that they tell, and how many superhero movies there are versus how many romantic comedies. There's definitely patterns and a lot of forethought into the kinds of movies that Hollywood studios put out. But I would love to see that kind of organization and forethought with Black communities and having that output so that we know, like, every year we're going to see a Black superhero movie and we all plan to see that movie. So I think that's one thing that I'd love to see happen.
What haven't I asked you about that you feel is important that you would like our listeners to hear?
Just this double standard that Blacks often face in Hollywood about in life in general, where you're put up to a different standard. And there's this saying that people often remark where Blacks have to work twice as hard to get half as much. I'm sure you've heard that saying at some point. But in Hollywood, and in life in general, I think it's time to accept. In some ways, it's time to accept this idea of Black mediocrity for Hollywood, that Black movies don't have to do phenomenally well. We don't have to only support them when they're breaking records, when they make $1 billion globally. That shouldn't be the only time that we rally behind Black directors. Even if they have a movie that flops, even if they have a movie that doesn't do well as expected, I don't think that's a reason to totally shun a director and never make a movie with them again. I think we definitely need to accept Black movies that perform just average, as in addition to accepting movies that do great and just accepting movies that also do poorly. We need to really embrace the full range of Black movies in order to then accept them as directors.
Seems like an odd rallying cry, but yes, let Black people be mediocre.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's definitely part of our cultural citizenship that we don't always have to be perfect. We don't always have to be outstanding. We also can have a okay day, and that should be just fine. We shouldn't have to lose everything, lose our career because our movie didn't make five times its budget or more than that. I think it's just acceptable for them to also be working on their craft while they're making movies, which is what white directors tend to do.
Right. Well, I think that's an excellent place to end it. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Justin Gold, and I have been in conversation with Dr. Marianne Arriga. Marianne is the assistant professor in the Department of Sociology, as well as the Institute of African American Studies, and is just out with her new book, The Hollywood Jim Crow. Marianne, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Justin.
And Justin Gold is an intern on this program. That takes us to 8:01 in the morning here at KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online around the world at www.kpfa.org. Coming up in our second hour, the roots of the housing affordability crisis afflicting California and many other parts of the country. We'll speak to Michael Storper, professor of regional and international development at UCLA, author of The Rise and Fall of Urban Economies. We'll get his take on the housing solutions currently under consideration in policymaking circles. That's all coming up next after the news.